Welcome to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner joining you with the third program in the series History Under Siege, a survey of debates and tensions about the past around the world. Today we're on home turf in Australia, which in the last decade or so has seen an unprecedented focus on history, from front page headlines in the broadsheets to media shock jocks, and as politicians of all hues, from Prime Ministers Gough Whitlam to John Howard, have ignited and inflamed the history wars in order to cement their own view of Australia's national story. History Under Siege in Australia.
For Charles III, this day was a day of hope. First they saw oyster shells upon the banks. Then they met an old aborigine. The old man pointed due south, describing the roaring of the sea and the height of the wave.
I believe that the balance sheet of Australian history is overwhelmingly a positive one.
The starting point might be to recognise that the problem starts with us. The non-Aboriginal Australians. It was we who did the dispossessing.
When I was brought up, we were perhaps too kind to Australian history, and I call that the three cheers view of Australian history. In universities, that was increasingly replaced by a view which I called, I made up the phrase, the black armband
view. View of our past reflects a belief that most Australian history since 1788 has been little more than a disgraceful story of imperialism, exploitation, racism, sexism, and other forms of discrimination.
We fail to make the most basic human response.
The Prime Minister, I think, is really engaging in another battle in the history wars.
The Prime Minister assured tonight's audience his party was as committed as ever to fighting the history wars.
The past decade or so in Australia has seen a dramatic escalation in debates and divisions over history. It seems that daily Australian history has been called upon, fought over, or invoked to justify contemporary policies and positions by politicians. So, in order to try and understand the wellspring for this increasingly intense focus on the past, it's necessary to look backwards to the origins of Australian historiography itself. And Stuart McIntyre from the School of History at Melbourne University has been doing just that. He and fellow historian Rob Pascoe have been researching the work of historians who entered the Australian Academy of Social Sciences after it was set up in the early 1940s. And they've found that the discipline of Australian history, as we know it today, is a relatively recent development.
After the Second World War, there's a considerable investment in higher education and research is when the university system expands, again because of a belief that this sort of research and expertise can improve prosperity and social life, and the humanities can enrich civic life. And Australians for the first time had their own research capacity in fields such as history.
In the history schools, the various universities in Australia before 1939, most of the professors were Englishmen who saw the history of Australia as a branch of British colonial history. The beneficent influence of the British in the world as colonisers and empire builders.
In Charles Sturt's words, the old man pointed due south. It was evident this old man had been upon the coast, and we were therefore highly delighted at the prospect then held out to us of reaching it. A day of hope for Charles Sturt. Would that he could see the barren land that he explored, made green and fertile as it is today.
From the 1951 ABC radio documentary, which featured a reenactment of Charles Sturt's 19th century expedition into the centre of Australia in search of an imagined inland sea. That the subject of this documentary featured the epic journey of a colonial explorer reveals a great deal about how Australian history was perceived in the 1950s. Stuart McIntyre again.
I think if you go back in the 50s and 60s, you would find it difficult to discover public discussion of history along political lines. One of the things that strikes you if you go back and have a look at 1951, which was the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the Commonwealth, the commemoration program was pretty small and had almost no historical content. Furthermore, Robert Menzies didn't want it to have historical content. It's rather odd for someone who'd studied history as an undergraduate at university. So that it doesn't very often get taken up by politicians. I think it starts to get taken up by politicians in the 1970s. Manning Clark's an important figure there.
Hiding to Cut 3 is from the 21st of May, 85. It's an interview with Australian historian Professor Manning Clark.
I'm sorry that I didn't start at a time when it would have been possible to have done more justice to the Aborigines. I think that there's a lot more about the Aborigines in those volumes than there had been in previous volumes of Australian history. And that for a very special reason. I had actually had the good fortune when I was a boy to meet an Aboriginal preacher called David Unipon. And he drew my attention to things that I had never heard of before.
Manning Clark's History of Australia, I think, had a considerable impact on Gough Whitlam and others of that generation, who saw it as suggesting that Australian culture had a depth. It coincided with the renaissance of Australian theatre and film and Australian themes in art. And Manning Clark was seen as suggesting what Australia might be. And that would lead to a conservative antagonism to him, especially when he became prominently involved in the argument over the dismissal.
The arrival by sea of the people who have made up the great waves of immigration to these shores, from the convicts to the boat people.
There were probably about 20 historians working in universities in Australia in 1939. There were 600 or 700 of them by the 1970s. So that's the high point, in fact, of the history profession and for a number of the professions in the humanities and social sciences.
I hope Australia Remembers will add to our nation's understanding and confidence about our place in the world,
an unarmed man,
and our capacity to play a
with a donkey
and humane part in it,
who over some 40 days rescued a number of injured and wounded men.
Born of the Australians who had endured World War I and the Great Depression, they fought a war in defence of the country they loved, and they bequeathed to their children the opportunities which they themselves had been denied. They were nation builders, and our freedom was their legacy.
Of what Simpson and his donkey represents, then we will lose our direction as a country.
I mean, our starting point in this study is to imagine that history is an incredibly important staple diet for politicians whose task it is to persuade people. If you want to establish legitimacy and authority for your arguments, history is extremely valuable. We think that history is deployed often, whether it be talking about turning points, whether it be talking about doing things new, establishing a break with the past. These are all invoking history.
Historian David Lowe from Deakin University, who's been looking at the ways in which Australian politicians have used and very possibly abused history since Federation. Lowe argues that an analysis of the use of the past by politicians in their speeches and public rhetoric will help reveal the central role that history plays in contemporary society, that constant dance between the past and the present. David Lowe thinks that it will also aid the task, as articulated by one politician, former Prime Minister John Howard, of demonstrating the significance of history for an informed citizenry. So is it possible to look to the prose of our politicians and see the influences of that body of Australian historiography, which began to emerge in universities in the 1960s and 70s?
In terms of the great influences on politicians and influences taking the shape of those who write great history, then yes, Australian historiography comes into its own probably from the 70s onwards, realistically. And yes, you can see this. I noticed that one of Kevin Rudd's first comments about when he was casting an eye over Australian foreign policy, before he became Prime Minister, He was drawing on the work of a fairly radical Greg Pemberton, who wrote about how Australia got involved in Vietnam by a view which was very critical of conservative governments. And you can find, I think, works of Australian history being wielded in Parliament quite commonly from 1980s onwards. So I suppose the Australian writing, the canon, comes into its own more from that point onwards. Before that, if my research suggests a few things, it is that they're very beholden still to great works by British historians, including Winston Churchill, seems to have been drawn on by dozens of politicians, in the 50s in particular, but also the classics of Toynbee, Gibbon, Empires Rising and Falling, this kind of stuff, and huge biographical works. These are the ones that seem to be the stable diet of politicians until we get into that 70 zone, as far as I can see. But I agree with you, in more recent times it's become interesting as to which historians are drawn on, and I suppose there's been an increasingly polarised view of who you go to.
The current Prime Minister must be one of the few leaders from any era in any nation who appears to have so little respect for his own country's history that he is attempting to rewrite it.
I tell you, I learned one thing. I learned about self-regard for Australia. Yeah. Not about some cultural cringe to a country which decided not to defend the Malaysian Peninsula, not to worry about Singapore, not to give us our troops back to keep ourselves free from Japanese domination. This was the country that you people wedded yourself to, and even as they walked out on you and joined the common market, you were still looking for your MBEs and your knighthoods and all the rest of the regalia that come with it. You would take Australia right back down the time tunnel to the cultural cringe where you've always come from. The same old fogyism of the 1950s. We won't have a bar of it. You can go back to your 50s, to your nostalgia, to your Menzies, the Caseys and the whole lot. They were not aggressively Australian. They were not aggressively proud of our culture. And we'll have no bar of you or your sterile ideology.
The key issue for Keating, I think, is he understood how to connect history with symbolic acts, such as kissing the ground when he landed in New Guinea, that kind of thing he was very good at.
I mean, Labor politicians are more inclined to retire and write a memoir. That kind of memoir activity did buttress what was a fair appropriation going on about how Labor's writing of Australia's history, often a story of thwarted nationalism, of trying to you know, actually break free of a British embrace, if you like, that story was able to progress far further because of this tendency in who wrote what. By contrast, conservative politicians would retire and join various boards and not have time to write their memoirs.
87 years ago, General Bird would continue to write, "I shall always regard my time as a comrade of the brave and strong men from Australia and New Zealand. Today, our nation says farewell to the last of those brave and strong men." An essence that continues to define our nation's identity and the standards by which we judge ourselves.
Again, maybe let me just talk a little bit about a more prosaic story. Australia's victory, Australia's involvement in victory in World War II, was effectively appropriated by the Labor Party. They won the war. And if you look at the behaviour of Liberals in the 1950s and 1960s, they are recurringly tearing their hair out for not being able to own any part of that victory, even though they were in power for about half of the war. And they think they did some pretty good things before John Curtin came in. But they were so effectively written out by the way in which Labor historiography geared up very effectively, accompanied by memoirs and so on, that there is this sense of unfinished business about how to talk about wars. Mm. I think some of that fed into John Howard's thinking, but he found it much easier to leapfrog over World War II back to World War I, which is probably more fertile ground and probably not so appropriated in terms of who did what.
Teach Australian values or clear off. That's the message to Islamic schools in Australia from the Federal Education Minister Brendan Nelson.
Dr. Nelson gives the World War I story of Simpson and his donkey as an example of the values he needs.
It's about an unarmed man with a donkey who, over some 40 days, rescued a number of injured and wounded men. He was unarmed with a donkey, and he represents everything that's at the heart of what it means to be an Australian.
We have to draw a distinction, I think, between the way in which the past is used as a political resource and the study of the past. Clearly, prime ministers and politicians will use historical events as markers with particular sort of resonance. I don't know, when Paul Keating talked about the fall of Singapore, for him it symbolised the need for a more assertive nationalism. when John Howard talks about Anzac, he talks about a young country going to war on the other side of the world because its fortunes are at stake as part of the British Empire. I think that it's a sort of a mistake to think that historians should criticise that sort of usage, but I think one of their roles is to pay attention to it, to ask questions about it, to suggest that there are other ways of understanding the event.
What use is history?
I still think it's useful as supplementing the observations of people on what happens to human society, in human society, or if you like to go a bit further, of what human beings are like. I mean, there are only two sources on what they're like. One is to observe in the present, and the other is to know about how they behave in the past.
I think that the understanding of Australian history that developed in the 1960s and 70s was one that saw Australia, in a sense, coming of age and progressing to independent nationhood. It celebrated lines of public activity from the convicts through to diggers onto the goldfield. It esteemed traditions of egalitarianism and mateship. That understanding of Australian history would be contested by the new right and commentators from the 1980s onwards.
Stuart McIntyre. And according to his co-researcher, Rob Pascoe, the main challenge to those accepted views of Australia's past, forged over 30 years ago, came from a strange and unexpected quarter, economics. It was the shift in economic philosophy in the 1980s which would ultimately provide the tools for the culture warriors and those who mounted the first assaults in the history wars, both in Australia and in other countries. And for Rob Pascoe, whose own study of those inside the Australian Academy of Social Sciences includes economists, the seismic turn undertaken inside that discipline is rich in historical irony.
One of the things that struck us as a paradox in this study is that when we began thinking about post-war Australia, the economists began as the heroes, people like Nugget Coombs, really fundamentally improved Australian society. They were involved in the reconstruction of Australia after the horrors of the Pacific War. They really did us a huge favour as a nation, and they really are responsible for a lot of the country's, you know, enduring and valuable institutions. Then sometime in the 1980s, economists suddenly started to produce a different kind of idea of Australia. Australia as a society where it was reasonable to maximise one's individual worth and position. Mm-hmm. Neoliberal or economic rationalism came to be the dominant force. And so economics changes from being a discipline that's concerned with full employment, with nation-building questions, to being a discipline that's concerned with how the individual might do well in given situations. And so no matter what the issue was, an economic position was suddenly became the key one. And in history, as a discipline, this had many powerful and useful benefits. For example, it helped us think about the way in which convict society might have been constituted by different social groups than the ones we thought about, that convicts might simply not have been victims of an oppressive regime. They might have actually been agents of their own making. There was a whole lot of ways in which it actually made sense. But at the end of the day, it led to a fundamental change in the way in which conservative history was being written based around the individual needs and wants. And in that kind of context, what happens very quickly is that what I would call the real history, the longer-term themes, the social conflicts, the class conflicts, all these issues suddenly disappear from view. And so what we're left with in the new right telling of our history is some really pretty wacko ideas. And it's because the new right is fundamentally ahistorical that there are so few leading, well-regarded new right historians. It's not as if we've sort of sluiced out all the conservatives and got rid of them all. It's rather that it'd be very hard to be a new right historian and to take history seriously as a discipline, because history as a discipline makes a whole lot of assumptions about the way in which societies work and seeks to weave patterns and order with interest in the individual, with characters, with agents of various kinds, and social groups. So those sorts of categories fall out of the new right agenda.
Well, the Herald Sun newspaper came out this morning with a front page exclusive, "I Wasn't Stolen."
It's one of the reasons why people have been so reluctant to come forward and question the stolen generation myth. This very, very loose, reckless, does the cause of evolution, countless tens of millions of dollars. Stolen generation, stolen. Can you call that child stolen?
And as something of a counter to our concern with the ways in which liberals don't tell their own stories, conservative politicians are best served by well-funded think tanks in Australia, unlike the left, for example. And we do know that they have some commentators who are very strategically placed in major media.
The history wars were framed as an attack on the history profession by conservative commentators who, furthermore, I think had access to the mainstream media in an unprecedented way.
John Howard was 17 when Quadrant was first published 50 years ago. The magazine now claims it's the Prime Minister's favourite.
I'm finally succumbing to Peter Garrett's advice, and it's great to embrace an evening of culture and poetry and all of that.
Now safely in government, the Prime Minister assured tonight's audience his party was as committed as ever to fighting
the history. I do not take the black armband view of Australian history, which is so popular in some circles. I believe that the balance sheet of Australian history is overwhelmingly a positive one. Heroic achievements, remarkably enlightened, tolerant and diverse Australian community.
When I was brought up, we were perhaps too kind to Australian history, and I call that the three cheers view of Australian history. But in universities, that was increasingly replaced by a view which I called, I made up the phrase, the black armband view of history, where people believed that Australian history, in effect, was negative. And my view was that both were extreme positions, and I thought the black armband view was as extreme as the three cheers view once was. And you often give these speeches and nobody takes much notice of them, and nobody ever used the black armband phrase. And then suddenly Mr. Howard, after he came to power, he said that we were too much influenced by the black armband view of history.
Geoffrey Blainey is one of Australia's leading historians and is also known for his perceived affiliation with those of a conservative, sometimes called New Right, persuasion. In Rob Pascoe and Stuart McIntyre's study of the scholars admitted to the Academy of Social Sciences, they suggest that Geoff Blainey might well be the sole living representative of a so-called New Right position.
What we do in our study is, because we both have a very high opinion of Geoff Blainey, is that we differentiate between the young Blainey and the old Blainey. The young Blainey, in fact, is the author of many fine works which established a number of key themes which are now orthodoxy. One of them is that we were once British and no longer British. There was our Britishness slipped away from us as we became an independent nation sometime about the 1940s. Secondly, that we did dispossess the Aborigines, and we, in fact, he wrote brilliant stuff around Aboriginal culture and life. And thirdly, is the fundamental proposition that we've been multicultural is also really clear in the young Blainey. And in fact, Geoff Blainey has been drawn into the history wars really unwittingly, and because beginning with his famous speech at Warrnambool in 1984. But it's more what Blainey is said to say rather than what Blainey actually says that's important. And both sides of that debate in the 1980s characterised Blainey in ways that were useful to their positions rather than what Blainey really says in his works. So Blainey comes through this as a fine historian who does understand a lot about Australian life and does understand some of the nuances of our history. And yet, he's drawn upon by conservative and New Right politicians.
Injustices were done in Australia, and no one should obscure or minimise them. The debate over Australian history, however, risks being distorted if its focus is confined only to the shortcomings of previous generations.
I think Mabo illustrated, a fundamental flaw in our legal system, and the basic story about the nation was changed, so people had to make very significant adjustments in the way they thought about our past and the way they envisaged the law. So it was demanding, I think, a lot of Australians to make that change.
First of all, I think we need to note that historians have been public commentators on important historical events. I mean, take Henry Reynolds, for example, who played a quite important role in, I think, awakening Australians to dimensions of the colonial past that had not been widely recognised. I think what happened is that as a result of conservative anxiety about such matters, a series of criticisms or waves of criticisms built up. I mean, one of them prominently was over the bicentenary and whether the bicentenary should be a celebration or whether it should be an occasion for reflection and how you should strike the balance. The interesting thing about that, I think, is that the criticism is of the historians who are immediately accused of a lack of patriotism or of belittling the country. They're treated as if there is complete uniformity amongst them. You could walk down the corridor of a history department and you wouldn't find any differences at all. And there's a sort of an objection that these are people who are out of touch with how ordinary Australians feel and are telling us how we ought to feel. The criticisms are made from the outside. I mean, from time to time, when conservatives got cross with Manning Clark, they would ring around history departments trying to find someone who would join in the criticism and encountered a reluctance. They confused the reluctance with agreement. Historians didn't agree with Manning Clark. They just saw no reason why they should join in that sort of witch hunt.
Current editor Paddy McGuinness also deserves our special praise for the way he has carried on the quadrant tradition of fine scholarship with a sceptical, questioning eye for cant, hypocrisy and moral vanity.
And what we find extraordinary reading through the main New Right publication, which is the journal Quadrant, is in fact how thin on the ground the New Right history is. It's actually, New Right history is history that's spoken not by the intellectuals and the writers and the professionals and the academics. It's rather, it's written by the journalists, the media commentators, the people who work in think tanks, and the politicians. And that's, they're the people who try to set the New Right agenda and try to drum up a different version of our past. And it's because they don't have a history training of the sort that we would sort of see as normal and legitimate, then their history is very, very shallow indeed.
Despite a more diverse and lively intellectual environment in Australia compared with past decades, we should not underestimate the degree to which the soft left still holds sway, even dominance, especially in Australia's universities.
John Howard didn't make a great deal of these matters in the lead-up to the election, but if you recall, he was presenting a very small target at the time. But he did announce shortly after he was elected that he objected strongly to the way that Paul Keating had used history and the way in which implied the historical profession collaborated with it. He had a particular animus against Manning Clark. And from then on, it was a sort of one of the strategies that he and the government would return to from time to time. Kicked along, of course, by the way in which it interfered in cultural institutions, most notably the National Museum, where in a quite extraordinary fashion it overrode the professional curators to insist that certain exhibitions had to be reworked.
Our culture has become more politicised. Now, you can point to that in many different areas. You can point to the politicisation of the public service. You can point to the debates around the National Museum. You can point to the ABC. You can point to history in schools. You can point to the citizenship debate. All of those areas, you can find evidence, very, very strong evidence, to suggest that the government over the last decade has not only been trying to foster certain debates, it's been trying to direct the outcome or the content of those debates.
Historian Mark McKenna.
Just under 2 weeks ago, I spoke at the opening of a memorial in Sydney to the men who died in what was surely amongst the worst episodes in our history, the death by torture, execution and disease of nearly 2,000 Australians at Sandaken in Borneo. No Australian would for a moment question the propriety and historic justice in the erection of the Sandaken Memorial. Yet there are people who will say that the memory of death by massacre, torture and disease, when it was inflicted on Aboriginal Australians, should be expunged. That to pay tribute to their memory is an exercise in guilt. That one memory is legitimate, the other the product of a guilt industry.
The current debate over Australian history would benefit from a more balanced approach, from a wider perspective, and from less preordained pessimism.
Well, I don't think we can be so selective. I say we must pay tribute to the good and the bad in our history, and that when we honestly do that, when we are not held up, but given the strength to make progress, we make it.
Which the soft left still holds sway, even dominance. especially in Australia's universities,
was that the High Court recognised Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people, Indigenous Australians, as property owners in their own right, not as people who had got property as a gift from guilt-ridden legislators. Conservatives who have always upheld the rule of law and above all have defended the rights of property were unable to make the conceptual leap to realise that Indigenous people now under the common law were property owners.
I think it's remarkable that over the past 30 or 40 years there has been a transformation in the way in which most Australians feel about that past, but things such as Mabo and WIC have been fundamentally disturbing of older conservative views.
Keith Winchtuttle is the author of The Fabrication of Aboriginal History, Volume 1, and he's written an article in the latest issue of Quadrant magazine about the critical response he's received. And what do the leaders of the history profession do, the deans, the professors? Did any of them praise your book?
None of them have praised the book. Stuart McIntyre, who's the sort of godfather of Australian history, the dean of Melbourne History School, he said, I'm persuaded that some of Winchtuttle's charges are true. He's never said which charges. And, of course, if some of them are true, then the logical thing is to ask is what interpretation should be changed. I mean, the history profession has really kind of closed ranks and is not accepting the sort of charges I've made, even though they can't refute them. In fact, what the attacks on my book have done have really confirmed that there's no credible evidence that there's large-scale killings of Aborigines in Tasmania by whites.
I think it's true to say that if you look at a number of the neoconservatives, they come from left-wing backgrounds where there is a sort of a fervour about their youthful politics that is simply, you know, 180 degrees reversal. And they find it very hard to accept that there can be legitimate disagreement, so that your opponent is unworthy and has to be discredited. I mean, one of the features, I think, of the history wars that anybody who's been drawn into it appreciates is that the way in which you might want to argue a position and to consider the alternatives and to suggest where the evidence leads is very badly suited to the language and the conventions of exchanges in the history wars. I mean, there's a sort of an insistence there and a refusal to concede a point that is, I think, inimical to the whole enterprise of historical understanding.
Historical realism, the sort of perspective that I follow, that you investigate your facts and then you deduce your conclusions from the facts, that's kind of passé, and that instead of documentary evidence, we can now use Aboriginal myths and legends, and we've now got historians who argue these particular ideas should be regarded as kind of symbolic of Aboriginal and white relations, and therefore they are the authentic voice of history, that people can make up myths, they can massage the truth in any way you like. There's no checks on its veracity. There's no way you can have a dispute over myths. You can't prove one is right and one is wrong, or you can't, you know, dispute the details in them. It just means that you give history away completely. That, you know, people can decide the truth among themselves. A collective of historians who want to agree on a particular point come to a consensus, and therefore that is the truth. Well, that's not the truth. The truth is what the evidence shows.
My concern with Keith Winchtuttle's work is that it is actually poor history. It's not only that it's wrong, but it's poor history. It's forensic in the extreme. It doesn't have the gravitas, it doesn't have the sense of compassion for the people about whom he's writing. It fails a whole series of basic tests that we apply to history essays and history writing in this country.